Over the last half billion years, there have been five major mass extinctions when the diversity of life on Earth suddenly and dramatically contracted. Scientists are currently monitoring the sixth extinction, predicted to be the most devastating since the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs. However, this time around, we are the asteroid. New Yorker staff writer and author Elizabeth Colbert offers a startling look at mass extinction currently unfolding before us in her new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It is a great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Colbert to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me.
When did you come to really latch on to the term and to the idea of a sixth extinction?
Well, this book sort of grew out of another book that I wrote, which is now almost a decade ago, and that book was on climate change. And I was looking around, I thought, well, climate change is, you know, just a huge topic. I haven't exhausted it. And I was looking around for another book to write on climate change, and I kept bumping up against this idea that climate change was really just one of the ways that we are changing the planet on a geological scale, a scale that will be permanently inscribed in Earth history. And that is how I came in contact with this idea that we are now in the midst or on the verge of a mass extinction. And it seemed to me, well, that's really the only story out there that's sort of even bigger than climate change. And that's when I began to look into it.
What makes this different than the other five extinctions?
Well, we do. That's the short answer.
Right.
I mean, the other five extinctions were all caused by, and in some cases, I should say, scientists are still, you know, very busy debating exactly what caused them, but they were all caused by some geological event, let's say, perhaps a volcanic event. In the case of the event that killed off the dinosaurs, and that was almost certainly caused by an asteroid impact. They were not caused by a single species. And now we, one species out of many, many million on the face of the Earth, is the agent for this extinction. So it's a very, very unusual event, unusual even, you know, in the broadest scope of Earth history.
What about timing as far as the rapidity of this?
What we think of as things unfolding relatively slowly on a human scale, you know, a human lifetime, several centuries, several millennia, that seems to us to be a long time. In fact, in the great scheme of things is virtually instantaneous. So one of the things that scientists have said to me, for example, is, you know, when the geologists of the future come back and look at the record of our time, our present moment, all of this is going to be reduced to this tiny, tiny layer. And what we're doing may look as rapid as an asteroid impact.
I think that is what struck me in the book is you're talking about maybe a little less than a century. I mean, that's 100 years. Say, in our lifetime from beginning to end of cause and effect.
Yes. I mean, I think it's very difficult to predict, you know, what will the world look like a century from now. We still have, I should also add, you know, power to determine what the world will look like a century from now. But the predictions, the models, modeling efforts, you know, if we just continue what we're doing, pouring CO2 into the atmosphere at what is probably an unprecedented rate, changing the climate, changing the chemistry of the oceans, chopping down, you know, the rainforests, moving species all around the world, all of these things have very dramatic effects on other species, then the predictions of, you know, what proportion of the world's species will be, and scientists use this word, committed to extinction by the end of the century, they're very, very high.
So let's get to that committed to extinction. How do we define extinction and what will be extinct? Because with this comes the rise of other species that cause the extinction of other species.
Well, extinction, I think, has a pretty straightforward definition, you know, to the extent that we can define a species, and that can get complicated because as scientists are unraveling the genomes of more and more species, a lot of a lot of things that either seemed like they were one species, now they've been divided into two species, for example. But to the extent we can divide, can determine a species, extinction simply means there are literally none left, right? So there are just no mastodons. Mastodons used to be quite common in this area, upstate New York. Famous mastodons were found, for example, in Newburgh. And people still uncover mastodon bones in the area, say around Orange County. There are no mastodons left. That is a whole lineage that no longer exists. So, you know, extinction has, a pretty clear definition. Now, the flip side of extinction, you know, should be speciation, right? New species coming into being, evolving, diverging. That turns out to be a very slow process. So we are not getting species evolving at the rate that we are seeing them going extinct. That is precisely the moment that we're in, where the diversity of the world is plummeting because species are going extinct a lot faster than new species are being created.
Why are we at this time having more of an impact on our Earth than we ever have before?
We've actually been at this project, you know, for quite a long time. As soon as people began migrating out of Africa, there's quite good evidence that a lot of species, you know, met their demise. For example, you know, our very, very nearest relatives were the Neanderthals who lived in Europe. Modern humans only got to Europe around 45,000 years ago. The Neanderthals were gone by around 30,000 years ago, and there's very, very convincing evidence now that humans did end the Neanderthals. The interesting twist there is we seem to have had sex with the Neanderthals. We seem to have interbred with the Neanderthals so that most of the people on the planet right now have some tiny little bit of Neanderthal DNA. You and I, both sitting here today, have a little bit of Neanderthal in us. So humans have been at this project for quite a long time. What has really ramped things up is the Industrial Revolution and the accompanying tremendous rise in our population, in our use of energy, right? Fossil fuel use has turned out to make many, many things possible. It's also turned out to be an agent of tremendous change. We've changed the atmosphere really, really dramatically just since the Industrial Revolution. We're changing the chemistry of the oceans very dramatically. And all of these things, as we consume more resources and as there are more and more of us, have really been ramping up in the last, say, 50 or 60 years.
It seems as though in reading the book, and as you just outlined, looking at our water, our seas, our air, that really nothing is coming out of this unscathed.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting paradoxes of the book was I went to some extraordinary places, this tiny little island, for example, on the Great Barrier Reef, peaks in the high Andes, the Amazon rainforest, really places that were pretty tough to get to. And why were we there? I was always there with a group of scientists who were studying the impacts of human beings on the planet. And the lesson there is you could go pretty much anywhere now. You can go to the North Pole and find human impacts, absolutely, in terms of, you know, there are pollutants in the ice up on the North Pole that are clearly were put there by, you know, by people putting things into the air that then wafted to the Arctic. There, unless you go to the very, very deepest oceans, you can probably find evidence of human impact. So there's really virtually no place on Earth right now that's free of human influence.
Let's zoom in for a moment and look at the coral reef. Look at just reef-building corals and what is happening there, and use that, if we can, as a distillation of the problem as a whole.
Yeah, it's a very, very stark example of what's going on. Coral reefs, as everyone knows, are fantastically diverse places. They're sometimes called the rainforests of the oceans. When you're actually on a reef, a functioning reef, of which I should add there are fewer and fewer, but it's not really fair to reefs. Reefs are much more spectacular than rainforests. When you're in the rainforest, all you see really are leaves. And when you're on a reef, you see the most amazing profusion of life, this sort of glittering world of incredibly colorful fish and rays and tortoises and sharks and just the most spectacular assortment of creatures you could ever hope to see. You can never see more diversity, you know, as a human being than by, you know, looking down onto a reef. And what's happening to reefs is they're under threat from a lot of different forces, as people know. But when I went out to the Great Barrier Reef, which is the world's largest reef, I was with a bunch of scientists who were looking at the impacts of the phenomenon that's known as ocean acidification. And what ocean acidification refers to the fact that when we burn fossil fuels, we put CO2 up into the atmosphere, a lot of that just gets absorbed by the oceans. There's just an exchange between the oceans and the air. So when you're putting CO2 in the air, you're effectively putting it into the oceans. And that changes the chemistry of the oceans, because when carbon dioxide dissolves in water, it forms an acid. So we are acidifying the oceans. And it seems that corals, reef-building corals, are quite sensitive to this. So there are many projections that suggest that if we continue to pour CO2 into the air at our present rate, then by the middle of this century, reefs will no longer be functioning ecosystems.
Elizabeth Colbert is our guest. The name of the new book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It is published by Henry Holt. Al Gore, in writing the review of your book for the New York Times Book Review, congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you. Very cool.
On the front page of the book review, said that extinction is a relatively new idea in the scientific community, because up until in the 18th century, nobody could fathom the idea of something so powerful of causing something to just stop its existence. And he draws the parallel to today, where we are having trouble with the whole climate change, global warming idea, because we can't fathom that either.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting parallel, and it's definitely a parallel that sort of underwrites, as it were, the book. At the beginning of the book, the first several chapters really are devoted to this history of science and the idea of extinction, which is actually predates evolution by about 50 years, and it was invented, if you want to use that term, by a French naturalist named Georges Cuvier. And before that, many very, very, very smart people really simply refused to believe in extinction. And one of those was Thomas Jefferson, who was very interested in natural history. He had a fossil room at the White House, for example, and he had these, you know, mastodon bones and giant sloth bones, and he really believed they were still out there. He believed those animals were out there somewhere. They called the mastodon, it's really an interesting chapter, it was called the Incognitum. And he believed there were incognitums, you know, roaming out there, and that Lewis and Clark would happen upon them. Until then, as you say, the idea was, why would the creator, you know, put on Earth a species not for all times? There was just this idea that everything that did exist now had always existed and would continue to exist. And it took this one man, Georges Cuvier, in right around the time of the French Revolution to say, that doesn't really fit with the evidence. You know, the evidence is that species have gone extinct. He called them lost species. And now we also have a lot of people resisting what is very, very compelling evidence that we are changing the world very, very radically. I think that will change as the impacts become just impossible to overlook. But there is resistance to the idea.
Impossible to overlook. What about impossible to overcome?
Well, the overcoming part is really the big one, isn't it? I mean, we're in this situation where first we have to acknowledge the problem.
Right.
You know, that is really, on some level, why I wrote the book. I think it's really important information for people to have and to think about. And then if you take the next step, okay, what are we going to do about that? My real answer to that is I think that is the question of our time. What are we going to do about that? Our ancestors, as I say, were at this project for quite a while. There are many extinctions that predate, you know, modernity, but we can say they didn't really know what they were doing. We do know what we're doing, and we have to sort of take responsibility for that and then ask ourselves, what are we going to do?
There are many scary things in the book. There are many things that will just frighten the zippers off you. To me, the one that really struck, not that we have to rate them, but the one that really hit me was ocean acidification. We're talking by 2100, we could very well be at a point where the ocean and the ecosystem there collapses.
You know, ocean acidification has been called global warming's equally evil twin. And some people would say many scientists would say for that it's its more evil twin, that ocean acidification is really, you know, maybe the underreported story of our time. It's actually quite difficult to change ocean chemistry. The oceans have tended to be very, very stable over time. And several different groups of scientists looking at this from different perspectives have come to the conclusion that by the end of this century, we could see more ocean acidification than has been seen on the planet for at least 300 million years. Okay, that's a long time. And the question of, you know, what is going to happen to marine ecosystems as we change this fundamental property of the water, because we're not aquatic animals, so we're not really in touch with what it means to live in the water. But if you live in the water, that's your only contact with the outside world. Right. And it can change. It's going to change everything from how much, you know, light is penetrating the surface of the water to how nutrients are cycled. It makes it much more difficult, and this brings us back to coral reefs. It makes it much more difficult for animals that make shells, all of the shelly creatures that we know, and external skeletons to make those shells and external skeletons. And what is going to happen to the oceans as those creatures drop out is I can't disagree with you that that's a very scary thought.
You say in the book that a third of the carbon that we pump out into the air ends up into our oceans. Is that because of the sheer volume of the ocean and its percentage of the Earth itself? Or does that have to do with a scientific absorption that the oceans hold?
Well, wherever you have the water and the air in contact, you're going to get an exchange of gases. Mm-hmm. So this is a calculation that can be made relatively simply but if you look at what scientists refer to as the partial pressure of CO2 over the area of the oceans, you can calculate how much CO2 you would expect, given how much we're pumping into the air every year, how much you'd expect to be pumping that would be absorbed by the oceans. And these calculations were done, but just to make sure, you know, that they were correct, very, very sophisticated, a decade's worth of these incredible missions where these vessels, research vessels, sort of crisscrossed the oceans and took water samples to test these calculations were done, and they came to very much the same conclusion that the oceans are absorbing about a third of our CO2 emissions. They do that very quickly. We put it up there, and about a third gets absorbed in the surface waters of the ocean. Over vast amounts of time, even more will be absorbed by the oceans as the water turns over.
You bring out this point in the book, and you do this through various examples, but it is fascinating because we as humans get very concerned about a single species and the loss of a single species, and we go beyond the call of duty to try to save that species.
Right.
But when you look at this sixth extinction and this mass extinction, why are we not taking to the streets over that?
As part of the book, I went and visited people who were really, as you say, going to these, you know, heroic lengths to save species. So one of the things that I watched, for example, was a rhino getting an ultrasound in the Cincinnati Zoo. This is a Sumatran rhino. There's only about 100 of them left in the world, and two of them are at the Cincinnati Zoo, and they're very much hoping that the female will get pregnant and, you know, produce another rhino in this to increase this very, very small population. And they're so desperate, I should add, that those rhinos are siblings. They're trying to mate siblings at this point, breed siblings, because they're so desperate. So people go to great lengths, as you say, to save individual species. And I think that people relate to individual species. So each of the chapters in the book is actually focused on a species,
right,
a different species. And it's precisely because I think, you know, biodiversity as a broad concept is something that just has no meaning for us. You know, what is that? It's one of those broad categories that we really can't relate to, that we don't have any visceral or emotional relationship to. Whereas if I see a panda and I think that panda, there are not going to be any more panda cubs, I feel a tug, both on an emotional level and an intellectual level. And so I think that, you know, we all relate to stories, we all relate to individuals, and that is exactly what I've tried to do, to bring what is an issue that's almost so big that it's hard to be grasped to the point where people can viscerally relate to it.
I do want to talk about the writing aspect of it, because obviously your job becomes almost that of a translator. This is what the science says, and this is what this means to us.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I very much felt, and if you read the scientific literature, which I, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I read a lot of it in the course of reporting this book, there's a real sense of alarm in there, obviously. You know, many, many people are watching their whole subject matter, you know, disappear. And that has not, as you say, translated. Somehow that hasn't gotten across this barrier from the scientific world to the general public. And that is exactly what I'm trying to do, is sort of speak this language that most people speak, which is not the language of academic science. And I found that the scientists that I went out with, and I went out with some really wonderful people, as I say, to some pretty remote parts of the world where, you know, they had to bring another person, which wasn't always easy. And I think they were very, very generous with their time and with their expertise, I think because they want this message to get out. They would like people to be aware of how extraordinary the moment that we live in really is.
Do they have a frustration that things are, that they see firsthand the impact and that message isn't getting out?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the scientists I quote in the book, for example, he's a herpetologist. And so in his case, he deals with amphibians. And he said, I got into this because I love animals. I didn't expect it to become a form of paleontology. You know, so people who are amphibians have the dubious honor of being the world's most endangered class of organisms. So if you're out there working with amphibians, chances are that you have seen some of your subject species radically decline and perhaps disappear just in the last, say, 20 years. So people are looking at this and they are, you know, absolutely filled with horror. Now, many of these species, you know, you had to get out into pretty remote areas to see them. So if you're sitting here, you know, in Albany, you didn't watch them disappear. But precisely those people who are out there caring and studying them are watching them disappear.
So with all of this, where does your optimism lie? Or are you optimistic at all?
Well, the only thing I can say to that is that people are very clever. That's why we're in this situation. People are very smart. They're very mobile. They're very social. We have these tremendous societies that have these tremendous technologies. And that turns out to be, you know, potentially very dangerous for other organisms that can't evolve quickly enough to adapt to the ways that we're changing the world. And if we used our intelligence, our collective intelligence, to try to grapple with these problems, it seems to me possible that we could make a big difference, that we could minimize our impacts. Now, the distressing thing is right now we seem to be, you know, maximizing our impacts. It's almost hard to think of ways that we could be having more of an impact than we're having right now. So, you know, the only thing that really gives one any sense of optimism is this idea that people are, as I say, very resourceful, and they've risen to really, really tremendous challenges. The point is, though, that we have to be aware of this challenge, and that is, as I say, exactly, you know, what I hope the book will help raise that kind of awareness.
Elizabeth Colbert's latest is The Sixth Extinction in Unnatural History. The book is published by Henry Holt. Elizabeth, it's always a pleasure to have you before our microphones. I thank you so much for being with us and for the important work you're doing.
Thanks a lot. Thanks
Great
for
pleasure.
Having me.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.